Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your body down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a world-renowned Nobel Prize-winning economist and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. During the Clinton administration, Dr. Stiglitz was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers from 1993 to 1995 and its chairman from 1995 to 1997. He then became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. Dr. Stiglitz's books include Globalization and Its Discontents, Making Globalization Work, and The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, co-authored with Linda Bilmes. His latest book is Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World's Economy. He has an article out now, widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
And the book that you and Linda Bilmes did earlier, you're saying that the costs of the war since 9/11 have already exceeded what were your conservative calculations back then, 3 years ago, of $3 to $5 trillion.
That's right. The additional cost, we were deliberately conservative in our estimates, and the one set of numbers that have come in considerably higher than we had anticipated was the very large number of fraction of those returning veterans that are disabled. It's approaching 50%, much higher than it has been was in previous wars. And the disabled are very expensive to provide medical care and provide disability benefits. So the cost of disability, we estimate over coming years, decades, will be somewhere between $650 and $950 billion.
And this involves 600,000 returning veterans have been treated so far in veteran facilities. So there must be degrees of injury.
Oh, that's right. One of the distinctive aspects of this war is that a very large fraction are coming back with multiple injuries. So it is not only that a larger fraction are coming back disabled, a larger fraction of those that are disabled are coming back with multiple disabilities.
And you don't, of course, and you can't factor in other social costs like veteran suicides and family breakups, etc.
No, we didn't estimate the cost of that, but we have noted that those numbers, too, have been skyrocketing and far higher than we had anticipated.
Well, this is surely a big difference there from the $60 billion which the Bush administration told us that the war would cost from the beginning. You've written here, colossal incompetence met dishonest misrepresentation.
That's right. I don't know which was worse, but I do think they deliberately tried to hide the cost from the American people. And one of the things that we pointed out is that in their attempt to hide the cost, it led them to make some very bad decisions. For instance, not to provide body armor, not to purchase the mine-resistant vehicles that would have saved hundreds of lives and would have saved thousands of people from very severe disabilities. So their deception has been enormously costly to so many of our veterans.
Well, Joseph Stiglitz, they also didn't pay for it. They didn't budget this in the normal way. This was off the books as a supplemental.
That's right. And one of the things that, again, we point out is this is the first war in, I think, America's history, almost any country's history, that was entirely paid for, as we put it, on the credit card, entirely paid for by debt. In fact, as we started the war in 2003, and we were already running large deficits, President Bush engineered a tax cut that was well beyond our country's ability to afford.
And Joseph Stiglitz, of course, we all know the famous remark by Alan Greenspan, and that it was all about oil. But as far as I can tell, the United States has not been the beneficiary of any oil from Iraq. I'm not sure if anybody has. That oil's been off the market for a long time. Apparently, there are massive reserves there. It could be the largest, or certainly the second largest oil reserves in the world. But that because of decades of neglect, it'll take a lot of investment to get it out. But clearly, the price of oil in the meantime has gone up. And surely you have to factor all these costs that you're telling us about have to be factored in.
That's right. And that's why the costs are not just the budgetary costs. Sometimes people focus on the cost to our budget. That cost is enormous. But beyond the budgetary cost are the broader costs to the economy. And you put your finger on one of those major costs. The war disrupted the flow of oil, led to higher oil prices. Prices of oil were about $23 a barrel at the time we went to war. Futures markets, recognizing there would be increasing demand, anticipated there would be matching increases in supply so that the price of oil would remain around $23, $25 a barrel for the next decade. And we all know what happened then. It went from 25 to 50 to 100 to 140. This actually is very closely connected with the crisis that we're now going through, because when the oil started skyrocketing, Americans who were so dependent on imported oil were spending more and more of their money abroad rather than at home. And that would have led to a severe economic downturn. The Fed stepped in and prevented that from happening. What did they do? They had lax regulation, low interest rates. They created a bubble. So the bubble was how we kept the economy going in the face of high oil prices. And, of course, we now know the consequences of the bubble. When the bubble broke, the economy went into this deep recession. It's already 3 years since the recession began, almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in December, and the official unemployment rate is 9%, a little over 9%. But in fact, 25 million Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one.
And if, of course, Dr. Stiglitz, if Alan Greenspan is right, then you'd have to factor, and saying this was all about oil, this war, then you have to factor the cost of the war in and add that to the price of oil, right? I mean, if you accept his logic.
That's right. The overall point, though, is that we should have done a more careful calculation. This was a war of choice. We didn't have to. It had no relations to 9/11, no relation to Al-Qaeda, even though the Bush administration, part of its deceptive marketing of the war was that there was a connection. We now know that there was absolutely no connection. And so when you have a war of choice, you have to think about the benefits and the costs. And any cold calculus of those benefits and costs would certainly raise the specter that we would lose, and we did lose very badly.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He has an article out now widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. But surely adding to the 3 to 5 trillion plus that you've added, and you've adding up to 900 billion extra for the extra costs of the wounded and maimed and the psychologically scarred veterans, surely what Colin Powell warned about, the terrorist industrial complex, has happened. There's a study from Dana Priest and William Arkin, Top Secret America, that outlines what's happened since 9/11. And various people, John Mueller at Ohio State, say it's about, we spent about $1 trillion domestically since 9/11 on Homeland Security. What's your understanding of the?
Well, there are several aspects of this. In more accounting in our book, we only attributed to the war portion of the increased spending by the Defense Department that was not allocated to the war. I mean, the interesting thing, even though the Cold War was over, as the war on terrorism went up, so-called war on terrorism went on, defense spending went up way more than the what was being spent in Iraq and Afghanistan. We attribute about a quarter of that increase to the wars, and that meant that there were still hundreds of billions of dollars additional money going into defense. And I think in one way or another, much of that was generated, as you call it, by the military-industrial terrorism complex. And the contractors and the others were making large profits out of what was going on. One of the things we pointed out in this article is the large fraction of money that went to the contractors that has now been identified as wasted and corrupt.
Well, I suppose, though, if you do have a war on terror, which is the overall backdrop to these other two wars we've had, you could count it as the third war. And therefore, if we spent a trillion at home on homeland security, then that has to be added in, surely.
That's right. So I don't know how you calculate the total amount when you look at homeland security, but just looking at the increased Defense Department expenditures since 9/11, you'd have to say it's somewhere around $2.5 trillion, and that doesn't include the debts that we will have to pay. Again, about $1 trillion, for instance, for disabled returning veterans. So these wars, as you might call them, have been extraordinarily expensive. Needn't be. They could have been waged in a much more intelligent way. And that was one of the points that we raised, that because the way we did it was not as thoughtful as it could have been, the costs have been much larger than they needed to have been.
Well, surely you're being polite when you say it wasn't thoughtful. It was dishonest, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was dishonest. But even within the dishonesty, you would have thought they could have carried out their mission with greater thought and greater intelligence. And I think what is so striking is how badly the whole enterprise was carried out. And as I say, I think the two issues are somewhat related because they were trying to deceive Americans, because they were using deceptive accounting, and they didn't have the numbers, they didn't have the administrative processes, the accountability that would have, I think, checked against some of these abuses. And it's why we want, in all aspects of government, more transparency. When you have more transparency, there are more people looking over what is being done, and therefore a greater ability to correct mistakes when they occur.
Well, it's an extraordinary contrast if you think about George Bush Sr.'s foreign policy and his war in Iraq, where the war was paid for by the Japanese and the Saudis, and the U.S., after Saddam had been kicked out of Kuwait, the U.S. still had a hegemonic control of that part of the world, and which, after all, is the oil supplies of our economic rivals in Europe and in Asia. Now, because of the bungling by Bush Jr., the U.S. hegemony is all but shredded. Our rivals are making separate oil deals and getting in where they can. And the price of oil, I think, is going to be permanently high, isn't it? Because the Saudi regime is so afraid of the Arab Spring that they have to bribe their younger generation so that they won't take to the streets. And that means at least $100 a barrel oil, doesn't it?
Well, I think the likelihood that the price of oil will remain, as you say, at least at $100 is very high. One of the things I spent some time in the last year in the Middle East, and one of the things that is so clear is the anger with the United States. We wanted to win influence, demonstrate our power. Instead, we lost power. We lost power in three ways. We lost power militarily, in a sense, because we showed that a country that was spending close to one half of all the money that was being spent around the world couldn't really pacify, win effective control over two very small pieces of land, fighting against two very relatively poor countries. So the credibility of our military power was compromised, and now they know, most other countries know, that we will be reluctant to use power. So rather than increasing the credibility of our military power, it's decreased. Secondly, more important than military power is always sometimes called soft power, our moral authority. And that was compromised by the way we compromised basic human rights, violated international law, violated the International Convention on torture, did other things that received widespread global disapproval. And then finally, at the root of America's power is its economy. And the way the war was conducted clearly has weakened the U.S. economy. So on all three scores, these wars have really undermined the strength of the U.S.
And I imagine when you're in the Gulf, Joseph Stiglitz, you got an earful about how the crash in 2008 eviscerated a lot of the sovereign wealth funds of these countries, didn't it?
Well, many of them have recovered a little bit from that. Some of them are still having problems. Maybe not fully recovered. I think the thing there that, of course, is rather galling is the double standard where we went around the world, told other countries to open up their markets to our investors, and yet when Dubai wanted to invest in America's ports, we said, no way. And, of course, China had a similar experience. So there is a sense in many of these countries that there's a double standard, a kind of hypocrisy, and that, of course, also doesn't win friends and influence people.
But do they trust Wall Street with their money anymore?
No. But that's a rather different matter. I mean,
sure.
That's really the Wall Street's been shown not to be able to perform the basic functions of financial markets. Financial markets are supposed to allocate capital, manage risk, and clearly our financial markets misallocated capital and created risk. So the confidence in our financial markets has been clearly eroded, and the bubble to which lax regulation and low interest rates that were in some sense, as I said before, associated with trying to offset the fact that we were spending so much on importing oil has really cost America a lot in its economic leadership.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I know the last time we spoke was a while back when we talked about when you were concerned about Europe and not having a kind of Federal Reserve and having to rely on this European Central Bank, and you were concerned that problems in the non-Eurozone in the East may creep across to the West. But interestingly enough, something different happened. There's a North-South divide now in Europe, isn't there?
That's right. That's a rather different issue. But
yeah, I know. I just wanted to. I just recall our last conversation. You know,
when the euro was founded, many of us were skeptical. What we were aware of is they had taken away two of the instruments of adjustment, interest rate and exchange rate mechanism, and they hadn't put anything in its place. And we all said, oh, you know, things will go well as long as things are going well. But when a crisis happens, in the absence of these adjustment mechanisms, without anything replacing it, is going to mean trouble. And that is precisely what happened. And what I find deeply disturbing is that while the euro was, the founding of the euro was supposed to bring Europe together, it's really divided it. And the lack of solidarity that's so evident as Europe debates what to do with Greece and Spain and Ireland and Portugal and Italy, the lack of solidarity is really undermining European unity.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Joseph Stiglitz.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a world-renowned Nobel Prize-winning economist and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. During the Clinton administration, Dr. Stiglitz was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers and later the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. He then became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. And his latest book is Free Fall, America's Free Markets and the Sinking of the World's Economy. Prior to that, he wrote The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Now he has an article out, widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the shrinking middle class. I learned a good way.